WMMC HD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Enlightened philosophers tell us that we are divine beings in human form. Let's get real here. How can we live a busy life with a job, kids, and a mortgage and still be spiritual? Join CJ Liu as she tackles real life issues through a spiritual lens and talks with experts in relationships, work, and more. You'll get practical life skills and learn how to touch, feel, and experience a whole new way of living. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
Live from the headquarters of CBS Sky Radio, Fired Up with CJ now at www.fireitupwithcj.com. For the next 4 weeks, we'll be exploring hope and why it is so critical to not only our own mental and physical well-being, but also the planet's future. Hi there, CJ.
Hey, welcome, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
I'm excited today. I have Dr. Shadir here, Lori Shadir, and welcome everybody to the Fired Up with CJ show. And we're going to start off talking about hope because I think it's one of the most critical things. It seems from reading the book, it's mentioned several different times. Lloyd, we're talking today about Dr. Lloyd Sedir's book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care. In his book, he mentioned several times why hope is so critical. And so I wanted to start off, and welcome Dr. Sedir.
Hey, I'm glad to be here with you. It's actually Sederer, like Federer, the tennis player.
Okay,
call
Sederer.
Me Lloyd, but call me Lloyd.
Apologize. Okay, so Lloyd. So I wanted to first start off with, you actually have a great story about Dr. Carol North, and to me that was really inspiring about her struggle with mental illness and how she does overcome it, and I was wondering if you could start off the segment by just sharing that story with us.
Delighted to, and actually Dr. North just had an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about Katrina and about mental health in the wake of that disaster that came out yesterday. So the timing is very good. Dr. Carol North is a psychiatrist in Texas, whom I met when I became a mental health commissioner in New York City, and I arrived here after 9/11, and my office was responsible for tending to the mental health problems in the wake of the bombings of 9/11. And that was just such an awful event that stirred all kinds of distress and mental problems in a city of 8 million people. And I immediately turned to a number of national experts, one of whom was Dr. Carol North, who I'd met earlier, but I knew she was an expert on disaster and mental health, and she was a terrific coach to me during those years of trying to be responsive to the needs of New Yorkers. And it was only a few years later that somebody mentioned, oh, did you read Carol's book, which was the title, I don't have it right with me, but it was something like Listen or something like that. And it was the story of her experience of having a series of psychotic episodes when she was first in college and then at the beginning of medical school, and how these caused her back then to have to leave school for a while, to believe that she wouldn't be able to have a successful future. And in fact, she was able to build a life. She was able to put that illness behind her and go on to a career where she's advising the White House, advising mental health commissioners like I was in New York City at that time, and even to today, where we've had Hurricane Sandy and as a medical director in New York State. So Carol North is an example of somebody who suffered serious mental illness in her late adolescence, early adulthood, and went on to put that behind her and to make a life, a terrific life with not only work but marriage and family. And she's just an example of hope of how people can make a life even though they may have had an illness.
And is she the, you know, when you look at her story, was it because she had the comprehensive treatment that you talk about in your book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, that she had, she was taking the proper medicines, she was getting the correct counseling and help? I mean, did she talk a little bit about what got her there?
Yeah, that's really important, that pretending that the illness is not there, or trying to say, well, I'll just let it let time go by, is not the right answer. And in fact, there's a strong association between adolescents who have psychotic illness that's not treated and they're later becoming disabled, mentally disabled, unable to function in school and at work, according to how long their illness is not treated. That's called duration of untreated illness. And the longer that illness goes untreated, the more likely that young person is going to have a life of disability. And this is related to the progression of that mental disease in the brain. So early intervention, early treatment is essential to preventing later disability. And treatment, as I think you were also suggesting, is not just being on medication, though sometimes medication is necessary. It's about therapy. It's about a family, working with family to help them create the kind of environment that somebody needs for support. It's often about also helping people regain certain skills. Their thinking may have been troubled for a while. They may lose some ground. They may need some skill development in their thinking and their work tasks. So it's that comprehensive treatment that's essential for people being able to have a serious illness, recover, and build a productive life.
So is it a presupposition, or do you know that, in fact, Dr. North did these things earlier on, which is, in fact, why she can live a productive life now? Is that...
She's one of many examples of people who did have comprehensive treatment and it made a difference in her life.
Wow, interesting. Okay, now tell me a little bit. I mean, what's one of the things that when I was reading a book on hope, they talk about having realistic goals. You know, it's one thing, you know, to not wish things, but also have realistic goals. What are some, you know, and you had said that in your book, you talk about people being to have productive, happy, and full lives. And is that a realistic goal? I mean, and what are the kind of, what are the realities that someone has to face if they have a mental illness?
Yes.
And what are realistic goals?
Yes. Well, you know, I find it's always critical to start with asking people what they want. And sometimes we may think, well, boy, that makes a lot of sense. Or sometimes we may think, well, that's a little odd. Or we may think, well, that's, you know, being an astronaut, there are not too many people that are going to succeed. But you want to start the conversation with where somebody is at. Not what we think or even the family thinks are goals for somebody, but what a person's goals are, because that's where you begin to then build a partnership. Well, okay, those are your goals. Let's think about what you need to do to achieve them. Most people have pretty realistic goals, and their goals of being able to work, being able to, if they're a teenager or a young adult, to have friendships, to have a date, to be able to live independently, and to have dignity in their life. And those often are goals that may be different from a doctor, who may say, well, I think this person is, you know, we have to improve the way that they're eating or sleeping, or they may actually be hearing voices and we need to reduce those voices. Well, that's true, but when you are trying to form a partnership, an effective treatment partnership with a person, you start by understanding their goals. If their goals may be really, you know, to be an astronaut, then you say, okay, well, you know, where does that start? Doesn't that start with being able to go to school? And then you start to begin to then get closer to what are the next steps somebody can do and what do they need to do to take those steps.
Okay, and then one of the things, and I think that that's great, already get to what I'm hearing, is that I think that sometimes, and I don't know if this is true, it seems like there's so much stigma in society about mental illness, but I wonder to what extent that just prevents a person from even thinking that these goals are possible. Do you think that sometimes comes in play?
stigma does not help. You're absolutely right about that. And it may be the stigma that friends and community people in your own community or school may subject you to. And it also can be how somebody feels about themselves. So part of the work, part of the conversation is being able to help somebody recognize that, you know, that they're a real person, they've got real needs, and that they don't have to be ashamed of who they are. And you know, that seems to be often a problem, self-esteem, how people regard themselves is a problem that's not unique to people with mental illness. Most people have these kind of troubles, and most people do need to come to accept themselves and to whether they're ill or not, and it can be harder if they have an illness. And it's true also of people who have other kinds of illness, people who are youth who have diabetes, for example, or may have some neurological problem or serious asthma. So it is about people coming to appreciate that they're a unique person, and they need to make a life, and the more they can come to accept themselves, the less vulnerable they're going to be to those people who may want to pick on them or discriminate against them.
I think when I was reading your book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, one of the two things that were pivotal to me as a coach when I read the book were that people making sure as a family member not identifying your loved one with the illness. So it's, you know, that's my cousin James. He's a schizophrenic, right? So that's the only thing hints, right? His identity is he's James. He's not a schizophrenic. And you'd say it, and you aptly say in your book, you wouldn't say, that's my Uncle Sam. He has asthma. I mean, he would never say that. But yet, with mental illness, somehow we've grown accustomed to actually identifying the mental illness with that person and their identity, which I think is actually super important as family members to be conscious of. Well, the other thing that you said in your book and that you just referred to is that mental illness is like any illness. It's just something that happens. It's so different. I mean, it's different, of course, in terms of its symptoms, but it's similar to someone who has diabetes, cancer. I mean, it's an illness that we need to all accept and deal with come up with proper solutions versus, I think, have a stigma against where somehow that person is diminished. I mean, they're no more diminished than a person who has cancer, or, you know what I mean? Those are the two takeaways. Did I get those right, those takeaways?
Yes, indeed. And in some ways, they are different faces of the same coin, that being able to separate out you from your illness. It's not that you're a cancer. You may have a tumor. It's not that you're diabetic. It's that you have diabetes. Or even if you have some type of muscle problems and you can't walk, you may be paralyzed. You're not a paralytic. You're a person with a disability. And so separating out the illness from a person's identity is the first step. And then that puts you in a position to think then, how do you manage an illness? And that has a lot to do with getting good treatment, but it also has a lot to do with taking good care of yourself, having good relationships, thinking about the way that you manage your stress, the right kind of nutrition, exercise, the ways that we all can enhance our ability to have a life with more wellness. So illness management is contingent on being able to think of yourself as having an illness, and you're a person who's going to make a life even though you have an illness.
And then I think in the next segment we're going to be talking about some of the things that you talked about this segment, which is, you know, what is your responsibility as a family member for taking care of your loved ones who may have a mental illness? So don't go away. We'll be right back, and we're going to be talking more to Dr. Lloyd and his book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com. And call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
Believe. On CBS Radio's The Sky. The Sky.
We're back with Fire It Up with CJ, live from the headquarters of CBS Sky Radio, Fire Up with CJ. You can access any of her old shows, her new shows, or any information on her website at fireitupwithcj.com. She has guest Dr. Lloyd Setterer on her show right now. Hi, guys. How's it going?
Hey, great. Welcome back, everybody, to the Fire It Up with CJ show. I'm CJ Liu, and we're talking to Dr. Setterer, Lloyd Setterer, who is
thanks for having me on.
Sorry?
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for being here. So this segment, we're really going to be focusing on how important it is for you to act if you suspect that you have a loved one that may have a problem with mental illness, and how responsible action is so critical in terms of preventing future problems later on, not only potential brain damage that could happen. We were talking about that in the first segment, or having repeat episodes and a bunch of other symptoms. So in this segment, we're going to talk about what to look for if you suspect mental illness and what the risks are of not responding. So what is the risk of dragging your feet? And one of the things that you said in the book that I thought was interesting is usually from the signs, the symptoms, all the way to the time the family usually does something, the average time is 9 years before they react.
It's hard to believe, but it is true.
Yeah. So what are the risks? If you drag your feet, you had mentioned before that it's a progression of mental, it's a progression in the duration, it's untreated. Tell us a little bit what the risks are of doing nothing.
Yeah, I'm glad to. And let me also suggest to families that they trust what they're seeing, and that they trust their feelings. That often there something happens with a family member. They start to be different. Their thinking's not right. They tend to isolate themselves. They don't want to spend time with their friends. They seem preoccupied. And there's something going on, but you see somebody every day and you begin to think, well, maybe there's something the matter, and should I trust what I'm seeing? So I urge families, members who are seeing a loved one start to be different, to jot down a few simple things that they're observing, like spent the weekend in bed. You know, has two more notches to close the belt on his to fix his belt. Doesn't answer the calls from his friends anymore or her friends anymore. Basic things that observe that indicate that somebody is changing, you know, or is constantly now late for work or late for school, and then, as a way of noting what you observe, as a way of gaining some confidence that you can trust what you're seeing, because then a few days later you can pick up that list and you can say, well, boy, you know, I was right, it's still there. You can then turn to another family member or somebody you can confide in and trust and say, you know, this is what I'm seeing in my daughter, my son, my spouse. You know, do you notice some of this too? So you can get some validation.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are the beginnings of the conversation which you need to have with a loved one, which is to say, you know, I'm seeing something. It's not just me, your brother, your father. These are the things we notice, and we're worried about you. We're concerned. We have to figure out together how you can get evaluated, because something's going on here, and I know you may not think so, but we think so, and here's what we're seeing. So all of that is part of building a foundation for making a case for getting help. And then it gets to the reason that that's so important is because delaying treatment, particularly for serious mental illness, or illness where people have psychosis, where they lose capacity to appreciate what's real or what's not, where they may be hearing voices or seeing things or getting very paranoid. The duration of untreated illness for that condition, or serious bipolar, big mood swings, is in the range often of 7, 8, or 9 years. And during that time, there's a disease, there's a mental disease in the brain that's going unchecked, and you wouldn't want any disease in the brain to go unchecked, to progress, and because what's going to happen is someone's going to fall behind in school and work. They're going to not develop normally. There's something going on in the brain. It needs to be treated in order for people to get back on the normal track of
Is that brain things that you see with bipolars and any kind of psychosis or schizophrenia? Is it irreversible brain damage, or
the amazing thing about the brain is that it has what neuroscientists now call plasticity. Which means, and you see this even with stroke, people with stroke, they can move a function to another part of the brain. So even with a stroke where there's brain tissue that dies because of blood has been cut off to that section of the brain, people can train another part of the brain to learn to speak again or be able to move their muscles better. So the brain is pretty plastic, but it's much better, much, much better to prevent that from happening than having to try to rehabilitate from what has been loss of brain function.
Mm-hmm. My friend Sally wanted to ask a question about kindling. Can you talk? What's your question?
Hello, Dr. Center. I'm Sally in Seattle here.
Hi, Sally.
Hi. I have had depression or on and off for, baby boomer. And so when I realized now that when I had my first episodes, I didn't even know what was going on, nor did anybody around me. And what I read in your book about the kindling effect makes me wonder if it's really difficult for me now to think that I would ever do well without any medication. Could you say something about that, please?
Yes, please. Well, thank you for being so forthright, because when you are able to talk about your experience with depression, so can other people, and they can begin to get help. But kindling is a really interesting process that goes on in the brain, and it's borrowed essentially from, think about a campfire where you put some small twigs and paper, and then that kindles some larger twigs, and then finally you can get a log to burn, and then that log can ignite other logs. The brain, in some ways, with these diseases, is like that. At first, you have to start with kindling. You start with a little bit of where the disease comes once. But then the likelihood that disease will then happen again, that's called recurrence, increases. So it's easier for the brain to get on fire again, for the disease to come back if there's been one episode, if there's been two episodes, three episodes, four episodes. It doesn't take much for that next log to ignite. The brain has essentially begun to kindle itself. It's much more vulnerable to having a repeat episode of an illness. And that's why I think you were saying also then it's harder to go without treatment, because treatment is your best protection against another episode. It may be medications. It may be therapy. It may be some of the ways that you use your talents. All of those are ways that you protect yourself from another depression. But it becomes more critical the more episodes of depression or mania that a person has. Oh, psychosis, the more likelihood they're apt to have one, and the harder they have to work to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Mm. Yeah, so then it's not being pessimistic to think that I might have to continuously be on at least some dose of a medication.
I don't think that's pessimistic. I think it's realistic. Imagine if you had diabetes and you had diabetes for 20 or 30 years, you would know that you need to take your anti-diabetic medication, whether it's a pill or an injection. You have to watch your sugar intake. You want to exercise. You need to take good care of your sleep. All of these are ways that you manage your illness, and that's realistic, and it allows you to have a much more full and rewarding life, because you do.
Yes, and I know that it's always been a dream to get off of medication, mine and a lot of people that I know that have the same thing I do, and it's always such a heartbreaker when out of the blue you're right back in it again.
Yeah, you know, maybe you can help us understand that because, you know, the you know, people on who with diabetes or heart disease, they often want to get off their medication, but it doesn't seem to be as compelling a need as people who are depressed or have mania or bipolar disease. They much more want to get off their medication, even though, you know, as we think about it, it's just as essential as a diabetic or a heart medicine. What's so compelling about needing to get off that medicine?
You know, well, we actually have to go to break, so we're going to have to, we'll actually have to cover it in either online and going to your website where you have a Ask Dr. Lloyd, Sedera, et cetera, questions. So I just want to wrap up. So really the key message here is act as quickly as you can. Don't wait for 9 years because there's a lot of positive things that happen and a lot of risk when you don't act quickly. The kindling that we talked about as well as some of the other things. And then in Dr. Sedera's book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, there's a long list of things. He talked about eating. He also talked about socializing, moods, thinking, sleeping, hygiene. He'll have lots and lots of details in his book if you suspect that you actually have a family member who has a mental illness. So we will be right back and we're going to be talking about how to have that dialogue if you suspect something with a family member. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And Fire It Up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. Sky.
Welcome back to Fire It Up with CJ. We've got Dr. Lloyd I. Sederer, the medical director of the nation's largest state mental health system and the author of The Family Guide to Mental Health Care. I am Eric from CBS Sky Radio, and here's CJ.
We have Dr. Sederer here, and we also have Fred from Seattle. And during the segment, we are going to talk about how you bring up potentially a concern that you have that a loved one or family member or a friend may have a mental illness and how you might engage them in a dialogue. And so we have Fred from Seattle who has a daughter-in-law that has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And really the family is concerned with the daughter-in-law's ability to take care of their grandson. They have tried several times to talk to their daughter-in-law but have been repeatedly shut down. And so, Dr. Sederer, I was hoping that you could offer some ideas on a helpful dialogue and maybe work with Fred on some ideas.
Indeed. This is unfortunately a common problem, particularly with serious illnesses like schizophrenia, which is a illness that often comes on in early, late adolescence, early adulthood, where people have troubles in their thinking. And they may also hallucinate or be paranoid or fearful. And one of the common problems with the condition is that people may not be able to recognize that they're ill. And instead, when you try to speak to them, they get mad, or they say, leave me alone, or they say, you know, you're the problem. If you'd only get off my back, I wouldn't have a problem. But indeed, they do have a problem. And that's where families need to be helped. And I give some examples in the book of scripts about how to do this. But for example, like I said earlier, it's very important to jot down what is observable. You know, how behavior has changed, whether it's being in bed, not making it to work, not eating, a number of things that are very visible that you can begin the conversation with.
Okay, and actually we have Fred on the line here.
I am here. Hi, CJ, and hi, Dr.
Hi, Fred.
Sederer.
Hi.
It sounds like a terrific program, and I have looked at your book, not totally yet, but I've looked at a good part of it, and it's very good, very helpful. And in response to what you just said, this particular situation is one where she was diagnosed schizoaffective at least 10 years ago, received some treatment, and then in the following years would have occasional episodes where she resisted any form of treatment. And we're in a period of time right now where she's having some very serious episodes on occasion and totally unwilling to look at it or deal with it in any way. So I kind of reflect back on what you said a little while ago about asking the individual what they want. And as you just said a minute ago, what she wants is us to get off her back. We're trying to deal with her as gently as possible and not be too argumentative or too pushy. But given the fact that she does have a 3-year-old granddaughter, and we're very concerned about the little girl's welfare in the midst of all of this, it's a bit of a perplexing situation.
It's a very troublesome situation, particularly if you're worried about the welfare of a young child.
Sure, absolutely. So you've just mentioned it. I think a helpful thing to jot down various issues as we see them come up. But again, you know, over these many years, lots of jotting down and discussion has taken place, and we're having a lot of trouble encouraging her to get the help that she needs.
Yes.
I have some other thoughts
about that. Maybe they're ones that you've already tried to use. But I like to ask families like yours at that point, because your reasoning, your efforts are trying, the situation is getting serious, and I like to then ask families, well, what support are you providing to your loved one? Is that support financial, or is it a use of a car? Is it a place to stay? Whatever it is, I think that in a family, being a part of a family is a two-way street, and that we give as family members, and we also get as family members, and that it has to be mutual. And so if you're giving, if you're supporting, it's not unreasonable to say, you know, this on this, you know, it's not that we don't want to give to you, but we want to give to you in a way that it leads to your being able to be an effective mother, to have your life, and we don't see that happening, and we can't support you. You know, this is really hard because it's setting a limit, and sometimes it just things escalate that people get afraid of. But when the situation gets serious, sometimes that's the leverage that families need to say, look, you know, we love you. This is serious. We just can't stand by. Loving family members don't stand by when they see something that really worries them. And we're going to support all that's good about what you're doing, but we can't support you if you're heading down that big, deep hole that you've been in before. We're not going to support you until you start doing something about it.
And of course, from a legal perspective, it really takes some very severe negative action on her part for us to have any legal leverage to either have her committed or even to take custody of the child.
That's absolutely right. I had a editorial op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on January 12th of this year called The Tragedy of Mental Health Law, where I talked about how hard it is, how high the thresholds have become for people to take action where somebody's liberties are infringed, like putting them in a hospital when you know they need to be in a hospital, or someone's privacy is limited where families talk to caregivers. This is a pendulum in some ways has swung awfully different from the way it was 40 or 50 years ago. And you're a good example of sometimes you have to wait until somebody does something that's really dangerous to themselves or someone else before legal action could be taken. So that's why the leverage is a step before. It's not pleasant, it's not fun, it's not fair, but sometimes you've got to draw those limits before you actually wind up in a situation where you have the law on your side.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you for those thoughts. It's helpful, and we'll keep working at it.
Thank you. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
So follow-up question, Matt. I mean, this is presumes that you actually have financial leverage over them, but are you just saying withdraw all support, emotional support too, or just use the financial piece?
Sometimes, you know, the love and the emotions are leverage enough, but sometimes they're not. When the illness is serious, But you're right. Sometimes someone is an adult. They're on independent. They don't live in your house. They're not dependent on you for money or transportation or whatnot. Then your leverage is less, and that can be really heartbreaking to see somebody getting sick, and you try, but you don't have leverage, and you're just waiting for that shoe to drop when something bad happens. That's a really heartbreaking situation for families.
I mean, I think in Fred's situation, the worst is that there's a three-year-old that, I mean, are they just waiting until something happens to the three-year-old that's bad so that they can actually have legal action? I mean, that's the problem. Any other ideas for these concerned grandparents?
Yeah, well, you know, in a way that's leverage, which is, you know, here's what we see about how you're caring for your child, or here's what seems to worry us about that, and we don't want to call in authorities. That's bad for everybody. That's bad for you. That's bad for the child. So let's talk about how we cannot do that. Let's talk about how you can get some care so that you'll be the kind of mom that will feel safe about that. Will feel like, well, there's no need to get anybody else involved.
Yeah. It's a very tough situation
tough situations, yes.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I did enjoy, and I think it's really helpful, and in your book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, there's a whole section on a potential dialogue that you can have, but I think you brought up a lot of really good points already. Create really detailed notes, factual notes, that say, you know, here's what's happening, here's what we've been observing, we love you, we want to help you. Those kind of things are part of the dialogue that I saw. So get the book, folks. It has a lot. It is just chock full of really, really helpful information. In the next segment, we are going to be taking in callers if anyone has any questions. We will also tell us, Eric, when we come back, we'll tell you the phone number to call if you have any questions. We'll be right back.
The sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And Fire It Up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky.
Welcome back to the Fired Up with CJ show. We have Dr. Lloyd Setterer, medical director of the nation's largest state mental health system and the author of The Family Guide to Mental Health Care. I'm Eric B. from CBS Sky Radio, and if you have any questions for Dr. Setterer, you can call our hotline at 545-SOUL. That's 545-7685. Now back to CJ.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to Fired Up with CJ show. I'm CJ Liu, and in this segment, we're going to talk about the importance of making sure you don't go it alone. And in the book, several times, Dr. Lloyd Setterer, in his book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, has talked about don't go it alone. And what did you mean by that, Dr. Setterer, when you had that in your book? Because you have it several times. I interpret it as get the help that you need. If you have a mental illness, get the help that you need. If you're a family member, get support as well.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and it's as basic as often are wanting to, because of shame or lack of knowledge about where to turn. Keeping this all to ourselves as a family, not turning to, and there are many places, there are so many people with mental illness that there are so many people affected that if you just look around a room of 5 or 10 people, there are going to be people that are there who have either lived with mental illness or know other people. So I like to ask a family, you know, or a friend, is there someone you know who has had a depression or an addiction or traumatic disorder? A mental problem, because that's a person and whom you can feel you can confide in, you know, who's not going to blab all about you. Families can also turn to their primary care doctor or to their clergy person, whether it's a minister, a priest, a rabbi, an imam. Because these people, family doctors and clergy, they're every day encountering families who have similar difficulties. They're also, I don't know, just want to put one more word in, because there's an organization which I think is absolutely terrific, and I recommend it almost all the time. It's called the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And there are chapters in every state, and it's an organization of hundreds of thousands of family members. people who can provide information, referrals, understand and help you understand what's going on, and their services are free. So that's another place. So there are many places people can turn so they don't have to hold it all to themselves, they don't have to feel they're all alone, and they can get some direction.
Well, I was surprised because I think in your book you said, what, one in every four? What's the statistics on how many people have mental illness?
Yes, over, in the course of a year, one in five or people or more are going to have a mental illness that's going to affect their functioning. And these are, these are depressions, bipolar, eating disorders, PTSD, and many childhood disorders, ADHD, autistic spectrum disorders. So these are very common conditions, which means that you're not alone. You know, if you may think you're the only one who's got this in your family, that's not the case.
Mm. Now, one question that I had is I was thinking, all right, I'm going to talk to a friend or a clergy member or my primary physician, but what's the confidentiality involved? Because like you said, I don't want my friend to be blabbing to another person.
Yes. Yes. You want to think about who you turn to, but if you turn to a clergy person or the professional person, it's their obligation to protect your privacy.
Okay, so they're required by law or something to not.
Yes, by their own ethics and by their professional their professional training, that what gets said. There's even what's called the doctor-patient confidentiality. You can bring a doctor to court, and a doctor can say, "Well, I can't talk about it because it's a doctor-patient relationship."
Yeah, I mean, what are the typical questions that people ask you? I'm sure they come to you as someone to get help. I mean, when they're scared or frightened because they're shameful, I mean, what are some things that they should be asking their friends or clergy member? What do they ask you, and what would you say to them?
Well, often you want to get some help about where to turn. Is there a person, a social worker, psychologist, a psychiatrist in the area that they know and trust? Is there a clinic, a mental health clinic, or is there a hospital that has mental health services? Where are places that you can go to have an evaluation of what's going on, that you can talk your loved one into going? Because everything starts, just like with any medical problem, with a good diagnosis. So you need to know where professional services are available and how to access them. You'll also need to find that information about your insurance, because you many times there some your insurance will say, well, you can go here and not there, and you don't want to build debt. You want to be able to get services that are covered by your insurance as well.
Mm-hmm. So then, one of the things I found very interesting in your book, The Family Guide to Mental Health Care, there's a chapter that, even when you go to a psychiatrist, they really don't know anymore. I mean, they know what symptoms to look at, but they don't really know the amount, the levels of meds to give you or what specific meds to give you until they give it to you. And you know what your reaction is to it. That was kind of shocking and surprising. So that you have to be a really strong advocate for your own health care and making sure that you're getting the proper drugs for your symptoms.
It's true throughout health care. How many stories have we all begun to hear about somebody going to a hospital and, waiting in an emergency room and being ignored or being admitted to a hospital and the aide that comes in is looking for another person. Healthcare, unfortunately, it's complicated and it's human, so there can be many errors, or there may be people who really do a great job, and there may be some people who don't do such a good job, and you need to be able to be a strong advocate. You need to understand what good care looks like and advocate for getting it. And in the book, I don't expect people to go to medical school or psychology school and become experts, but rather I talk about certain basic principles that any of us can understand about good care. It's comprehensive. It's not just dependent on one thing like pills or therapy. It's more multiple things that are being employed, that it's continuous, means that it's ongoing. If you stop and start any kind of treatment, it's not apt to work. There are a few basic, that the treatment is safe, it's reasonable to ask what are the treatments that are available, what are the side effects of these treatments, what happens if I don't get treatment. These are all reasonable things that are p- p- part of becoming a good, strong advocate, and we have to do that in healthcare, not just mental health care.
Yeah, I think actually one of the favorite lists that you have in the Family Guide to Mental Health Care, your book, was the list of questions that you should ask. And I have a relative that was diagnosed with diabetes, and they were trying to put her on medications. And I said, I'm going to send you this list, because as you said before, whether it's health, you know, generalized health care or mental health care, you know, there are a bunch of questions that we don't even ask because we feel like we're not empowered because of the doctor knows best. And I really highly encourage folks to get Lloyd Sederer's book. It's S-E-D-E-R-E-R. S-E-D-E-R-E-R. And tell us a little bit about your Ask Dr. Lloyd website and how people can get to that.
Yes, I encourage people to go to my website. It's askdrlloyd.com, askdrlloyd.com, and on there I've got a lot of things that I've written. There's no charge to go to a website. There are questions and answers that I've provided and other kinds of things that I've written that may be interesting or entertaining to people. I do book reviews and movie reviews from the perspective of a psychiatrist. So my website's got a lot of material on it, and I encourage people to go to it. It's AskDrLloyd.com.
Great. And so, folks, I highly encourage, if you feel like you have mental illness yourself or that you have a family member with mental illness, this is really the definitive guide. I found it interesting, and I have neither. that interesting of a book, and I think generalized about healthcare in general. Good questions, lots of really good information, helpful tools. So thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks so much for, you do so much. I was going through all your website and stuff. You do so much for helping people, and you have a genuine interest for people, and I greatly appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much to you and to Eric for having me on. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much. And for folks, thank you for listening and increasing your awareness on such an important topic for us. 1 in 5, 20% of the people suffer from mental illness, and so hopefully you can increase your awareness. Next week on Fired Up with CJ, we talk to Stan Cox, who won the Atlantic Magazine's Brave Thinker Award for his book, Losing Our Cool, and we're going to be offering some hopeful and simple solutions to climate change. Have a great week, everyone.